All right. Hello and welcome to another episode of Matchroom Radio with David Diamante. That's me. I'm your host. And we conclude our Coley Guavatsky trio of podcasts with some great guests today. I'm really excited to have these guys in the booth. We've got a fighter who'll be fighting in the chief support slot on Saturday night in a tough 10-round super featherweight affair, the Welsh Wizard, Joe Cordina, and, of course, his trainer, the legendary Tony Sims. Gentlemen, great to see you. How you doing?
Great. It's great to be on the show, finally.
Absolutely.
Oh, good, David. Good to see you, mate.
You too, my friend. How's Bubble Life treating you guys? Been okay?
Yeah, it's a bit different, isn't it? I say a bit different. It's nothing I wouldn't be doing anyway on a normal fight week, but it's the only thing is different is me being able to walk outside. I only got a balcony, which is about 30 meters long, to walk up and down. So, yeah, it's been a bit different, but at the same time, it's not much difference, do you get me, apart from the outside walking.
Yeah, I mean, you've said that, like, really your life is kind of just gym and family. Yeah. So for you, the quarantine and that whole situation wasn't too much of a difference, right?
No. From when I started boxing, I got in and I just hit it hard. My dad said to me, if you're going to box, you're going to do it 100%. Otherwise, don't do it at all because you can get hurt. So
these are wise words.
Yeah, so that's the way I look at it. And after 2 years of boxing, I got onto the GB team and I was living away from home from Monday to Thursday, coming home for a weekend, and then doing that every week. So when it was time to turn pro, I moved up to Essex with Tony and doing the same thing. So I live away from home when I'm in camp, and then only spent time at home every other weekend. And then after I got a fight, I spent a couple of weeks at home with the kids. So yeah, it's no different. I just train, eat, sleep, train, and then spend time with the family when I got a chance to.
Yeah. Speaking of different, you know, like the last time we saw you, I think it was November 2019 in Monaco. That was your fight against Enrique Tinoco, and you won the unanimous decision. It was a great performance, you know, and not only has there been a pandemic, but, you know, you used that time to clear up a hand injury that you had. Can you tell us a little bit, first of all, how'd you sustain the injury? You know, what was the operation that you needed? How does the hand feel now?
I think it was, I'd actually done the injury when I was sparring Reese Bellotti. It won a hard shot, and I was meant to be on the show with Usyk and Bellew.
Okay.
In Manchester, and it was my last round of sparring, obviously my last week of sparring, my last week of hard graft, and done all the hard work, and It was just pretty much a move round, and I've just threw a shot, no power in it at all, and my hand went. I knew something was wrong.
Ugh.
And straight away I tried to sort of shake it off and then go back at it, but it just wasn't happening. So Tony pulled me out of the spa, took the glove off, and straight away my hand swelled up and I knew I'd done something wrong. And so we sort of left it a couple of days, didn't punch on it, and sort of seen how it went, but it wasn't happening. It was day and swell for the next like 3-4 days when I seen a specialist, and he said, you've damaged your metacarpals, but he didn't say how severely. I said, will I need an operation? And he said, no. So I've left it, I think it was like 6 weeks of not punching on. He put me in a cast. He said, just leave that and it'll sort of heal itself. But as soon as I started back training and started tapping on it, it just went again. So I was just worsening the injury basically, and I needed momentum in my career. And for me, I couldn't have another 3-4 months out of getting the operation and then doing recovery, because it would have worked out around about the same time as the whole pandemic and me boxing now. So yeah, and then on top of the pandemic with the hand injury, it would have been close to 2.5 years out maybe. So yeah, I ended up, when the pandemic came along, I ended up getting the operation. Basically, I'd done my index and my middle finger on my right hand, and they take bone from my hip and staple it into my hand and let it fuse together. So, yeah, it was quite a severe operation, and I'm just glad it's done, it's out the way, and I'm back to 100% now.
You feel great?
Yeah, I'm letting it go on the pads. in sparring, everything. So, yeah, I'm just looking forward to letting it go on fight night.
Tony, as Joe's head coach, given the pandemic and the pause, I mean, was this obviously just the perfect time to let Joe get his hand fixed and recovered? I mean, surely this has got to prolong his career.
Yeah, definitely, because in a Tonoco fight, he had an injured hand then, and he still boxed the 10 rounds with Tonoco, but he was landing it, and it was obviously hurting him. So I spoke to him on the phone. I said, look, this is a perfect opportunity to get the hand operated on through COVID, because no one knows what they're doing anyway. You know, it was in proper lockdown.
So, ain't that the truth?
Yeah, so... Last July, we got hold of Dr. Mike Hayton, who's the top hand specialist in the country, and he's operated on two of my fighters before, Felix Cashew and Conor Benn. And so, you know, he's renowned for doing the hand operations. And as Joe says, he had it done in July, and then obviously the recuperation period was not to punch on it for 3 months. And then he started punching lightly, and now he's full flow with it now. So I think he's really pleased that he's had it done. And it's like I said to him, you might have been able to have another fight or two with that hand, but the deeper you go into world title level, you know, the harder the fights become, and you don't want to have that in your back of your mind that you're landing it and it's not right. So I think it was a good time to get it done.
Speaking of that Tonoco fight one more time back in Monaco, I remember, you know, you had that great performance, and the Prince Albert, he was really, he loved that. Do you remember that? He came to you, he took a picture. What was that like?
That was amazing. Obviously, straight away, it didn't sort of sink in. And I remember him calling me out, like calling me over.
Yeah.
So I've gone over straight outside of the ring. and he said, let's have a photo. So we had a photo. And I'm sure Tony photobombed it.
I did. I got my arm around the Prince. I'm going home having a photo.
Yeah, so we both had one. And then I think we had one singly as well. So... that was good. And then only a couple of days later, when I'm looking for my photos, it got sent to me.
And you realized who it was?
Yeah, like, and I think...
Really,
I
who it
got,
was?
Yeah, I just got a photo with... and it's not as if I went over to him and he asked me for a photo. So, I was pleased. And I've got it on my phone. And, and I'll probably bang it on the wall someday.
I'll tell you, you know, you've done a lot of fights over there now, and I've gotten to know him, speaking with him. He's an incredible guy, and he's an incredible sportsman.
Yeah.
And he's really humble and down to earth, extremely intelligent, obviously. But it was great, and I saw that moment, and I loved it, and I was really happy for that. And I do want to say, I know that the Prince did get COVID, and I know he had kind of a tough bout with it. It was a little bit of a prolonged thing, but we wish him the very best, and we hope to be back in Monaco very soon. Tony, I want to come back to you for a second. I want to start by kind of asking you about your beginnings in boxing. You're obviously a world-class trainer. You've done a lot in the sport, but, you know, you're one of those guys, you're real humble. You don't toot your own horn. You're not out there, yo, me, this, blah, blah. You're not doing that. But I want to do that on the show because I think you're a really cool guy. And I think you have some great, great stories. And I think that the listeners would be really interested in knowing your background. I know you're from East London, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And you did a lot of boxing back in that time, back in Bethnal Green and that area. Can you tell us some stuff about that?
It was funny because we were talking about athletics yesterday with Mike Costello, and athletics was my first sport that I loved, and I still love athletics now, like sprinting, because in school I was like, you know, the 100 metres champion, run for the school 100 metres, so that was that's what I wanted to be. But when you're from Bethnal Green in East London, really the only sport for you to do is boxing. And my block of flats was bang opposite the Repton Club.
Mm.
So all my friends from school, it was a bit like a youth club, really. All my friends from school went to the Repton. And so I that was the first club I ever went to. And when I started taking it a bit serious, my dad's friend was a trainer at the Poplar District Boxing Club in East London. And he took me to there, and I started off there. I had about 70 fights in the end, and it was different days, though. It was different times and different days. There were so many fighters, so many kids doing boxing then. You know, just in my class alone, there was just loads of kids. Like, you'd enter the schoolboys, and, like, half your school was in the same weight category as you. It was really a mad time of boxing. And I think it was 60s and 70s was a big time in boxing.
Did you find that, I'm curious, because saying these stories like that, did you find that when school continued and you get back in the classroom, did the scrums happen inside the school, or actually did it cause more respect and you to end up respecting each other and getting a lot of good friends out of it?
Yeah, no, you met a lot of good friends. I mean, in my school in Bethnal Green, I can name a lot of the, like, you got to realise that a lot of the kids went different clubs. So there was, just out of Bethnal Green, there was Repton, Poplar, St Monica's, Crown and Manor, the Lion Boxing Club, St George's ABC in Stepney, Arbor Youth in Stepney. So all them kids from them clubs mostly went to our school. So you can imagine the amount of people. So when the schoolboys went on, you'd know half the kids that was in my school would be in my weight category. So, but it was all cool, you know what I mean? It was, like you say, everyone respected one another, and they was all good kids, good fighters, you know. And you'd enter the championships, and you just look down and you're thinking, right, I've got like 3 to 4 fights tonight, and then tomorrow it starts again, and that's just to get through your preliminary rounds, you know what I mean? It's just a different era of boxing completely then.
100%. And I just want to say rest in peace, Tony Burns, from the Repton Club. Yeah. Speaking of Repton Club, but I mean, you must have seen some just amazing stuff back then. Were there any big names that came out of there? Any famous fighters that you kind of grew up with?
Oh, you know, my idol growing up at Bethnal Green was John H. Stracey. His block of flats was just round the corner to our block of flats. And I remember when he won the world title against Jose Napoli's, I think it was 1976, I think it was, he won that year. And he won it in Mexico. And I remember someone painted on the bridge in Bethnal Green, like John H. Stracey, world champion. You know what I mean?
You must have been so proud.
Yeah, I mean, whole Bethnal Green was like, they loved John H. Stracey. He was a legend, you know what I mean?
Wow, that just sounds so cool, man. Yeah. Napoli's fan, he was a tough customer too.
Oh, he was a great, he was a legend, wasn't he?
Cuban-Mexican. He's from Cuba, but he lived in Mexico. And he actually had a couple bouts with a buddy of mine, Billy Backus. And,
And then we had little Charlie Magri out of Bethnal Green. He went and won the world title at flyweight, another massive name. He was at the Arbor Youth Club. You had Morris Hope out of Bethnal Green at the Repton Club. He won the world title, lost it to Wilfred Benitez. So all out of Bethnal Green, there was all great fighters at that time, you know what I mean?
Your call. Bethnal Green, East London, just a hotbed. A hotbed, unbelievable. You know, here in the bubble, we've got with us a gentleman that I think you might know pretty well. He's obviously an integral part of the Matchroom Boxing family, the Sky Sports family, a one dazzling Darren Barker. And, of course, you know, you were with Darren all through his career, and even before he turned professional. He just sings your praises, man. He says so many wonderful, wonderful things about you. And he says unequivocally, 100%, there is no way I would have won a world title if it was not for Tony Sims. He thinks you're wonderful. And I think he's wonderful. So that's a great endorsement. So by default, you're in a good place. Can you tell us some stuff about your time with Darren? And how that was?
Yeah, obviously Darren's another product of the Repton Boxing Club, another world champion that come out of Bethnal Green Boxing Club. And, you know, I met Darren when he was, I went to see him win the Commonwealth Games, actually, the gold medal in Manchester. And that's how I met him properly, and through Tony Burns Sr. And, you know, he started coming to the gym and training. I think he was going into the Europeans and then the Worlds. So he was sparring at my gym as an amateur, getting ready for them, and that's how we met properly, really. And as you say, he turned professional with me and won like British, Commonwealth, Europeans, and the world title. So he was with me for his whole career.
So that's what, 2013, Atlantic City, Daniel Gill. What was that like?
Oh, it was a fabulous night, because 2 years previous, we went to the same place, Atlantic City, the Boardwalk. And he put up a great performance against Sergio Martinez, who at that time was like the equivalent to Triple G. You know, he had that great, before he boxed Darren, he had the knockout of the year
Paul
against
Williams.
Paul Williams.
Unreal.
And no one really wanted to fight Sergio. And it was funny because Eddie rung me up and said the fight can be made for the WBC title. And I weren't 100% keen on it, I've got to be honest with you. But as soon as I told Darren, he said, listen, this is my opportunity. I'm fighting him. I don't care if everyone's scared of him. I'm not scared of fighting him. I want to fight him. So I went, fair enough. We'll take the fight, Ed. And I remember Terry Barker, who Darren's dad was, former ABA champion. I remember a couple of weeks later, him coming down to the gym. I was walking out the gym and he's walking in. He's never been to my gym ever the whole time Darren was there. And so that was strange. And I remember him coming in and he said, Tone, I need to have a word with you. I went, what? He went, you're not going to put my boy in with that Sergio Martinez. He's an animal. I don't want you to put my boy in with him. I went, listen, Tell. He's British Commonwealth, two European titles he's won. The next step's world title. When he wants to do the fight, if he's confident about doing the fight, then I'm confident. You know, and that was it, really. And Darren put in a really, really good performance. You know, he was in front in the first half of the fight. And broke Sergio's nose, I think, in the fourth round. And, you know, he got beat in the 11th round. But it was like one in performance that after that, Sergio sort of was not the same fighter after that. He fought Macklin. Macklin done well against him. You know, Murray, you know, he sort of, I think Darren exposed some of his skills because he was walking through a lot of good fighters before Darren. And I think he got a lot of experience from that fight going into the Daniel Gill fight.
Yeah, Martinez was on a tear at that time. What you say is absolutely correct. He was the monster in the division. Mm-hmm. You know, something that's interesting, though, is when you talk to Darren, he says something, and it says a lot about you as a trainer and as a person and about your coaching style. And Joe, I want you to chime in on this too and see if you feel kind of the same way. But Darren says, as much as, of course, he wanted to win for himself and this and that, he loved you so much, he didn't want to let you down. He just felt like, you know, he just wanted to win so bad because he just felt like he couldn't let you down. And it just, I don't know, it means a lot to hear that, you know, and he's a very sincere guy. And how do you get that? How do you get the most out of your fighters like that? Because he says he got the most out of me. He really did. But it was in a way that I wanted to do it.
Yeah, as we know that Darren's had a lot of hardship through his career. You know, we know about the story about his brother. And I think with a trainer and a fighter, I think you have to have that relationship. I feel that you have to be close with your fighters like a family. And that's the way I treat my fighters in the gym now. And I think that if I don't get that relationship with a fighter, I feel it'd be difficult for me and the fighter to mesh together and really believe in each other. Like, I believe Darren could win a world title. I always believed that. And I made him believe it in the end. You know what I mean? And like you say, he didn't want to let me down and I never let him down in the training. So I think, you know, I like to think of them as a family and they come to me with their problems. If they've got problems, you know, away from boxing, I like them to think that they can speak to me about it, you know, and that's the way we can go on together.
Incredible. Joe?
It was spot on. There's two people since I've started boxing now, and obviously as a pro, there's two people I don't, like Darren said, don't want to let down. One's there's three. My parents and Tony. Tony, he's up in the mornings with us, does the runs. He's in the gym with us. If we, like you said, if we got any problems, we go to him. He's our boxing coach. He's our friend, family, and he's a teacher outside of boxing as well. So, I think it's great to have that sort of relationship with your trainer. And that's the relationship all the boys in the gym got with Tony, and he's a great guy, great coach. And for me, when I first turned pro, I seen when I was an amateur, when he used to come up to Sheffield and used to bring Kevin Mitchell to spar, and I used to see how he was giving the advice and how calm he is, and that's how I don't want someone shouting at me and everything else. And Tony've never done that. He's always explained, if you do this wrong, it explains why you've done this wrong.
Mm.
But when I turned pro, I was looking for someone like that. There was a couple of trainers that I was looking to try out. Obviously, you gotta you've got to sort of have a look to see if you gel with that person first or that coach or whatever you're gonna do. But Tony was the first person I went, first trainer I went to, and from that day I haven't left. So yeah, he's I just got a great relationship. He's a great trainer, and I believe Tony can bring the best out in me.
I love that, and I have so many questions and so many things I want to say, but you know, you brought up, you said Tony doesn't yell. You know, he's not like that. And like I said, you are, the years I've known you, very soft-spoken and very humble. But, you know, as a fight trainer on fight night, things are crazy. It's loud sometimes. Now it's not because no crowds, but usually it's loud. And so your instruction style, how does that work? Is it more that, you know, you give instructions to your fighters, let's say between rounds? Is it that you just have faith that they know what they're doing? Or are you able to discern Tony's voice when he gives instructions kind of quietly in the corner during a fight? How does that work? I'm really curious.
I find that with Tony, like certain things he says, then you get the sort of gist of things of what he wants you to do. Or like, for instance, if he says, just keep doing what you're doing, or do this, do that, then you know you're doing well.
Right.
If he's like, listen, try that, just keep that up a little bit more, you know that's what you're doing wrong. You don't need to shout to get your point across. So, and I just respect that about him, and I like that. And that's how, if someone's shouting at me, it's just straight away, it's just on the negative. For me, it's all about positive. If you're doing something wrong,
yeah,
tell me I'm doing something wrong, we'll change that.
Yeah.
And that's what he does. And if my left hand's down, Joe, bring that up.
So does he do that in the corner, like between rounds, or is it kind of during the fight?
Yeah, in between rounds. Okay. Like, there's no point shouting everything. Yeah, you do hear him saying certain things in between rounds, but no point blasting your fighter with instructions through the round, because someone's trying to take his head off.
Yeah, of course.
You can't really take it in, but yeah, he's. For me, like in Monte Carlo, for instance, I remember coming back after one of the rounds, and he said, "Right, he said you've got caught with three left hooks in that round." He said, "Keep your right hand up." So straight away, I went out and I just kept my right hand, just defended every time he threw the left hook. So for me, yeah, that's how I want to be and be spoken to, and that's how he does it. And this, I just find it just works better for me.
You also were talking about how Tony does the workouts with you guys. Do you still do that? I know you're a great athlete. You have been. I know you, obviously you're a little older now, but I know you did a lot of body sparring with your guys, but you also had a shoulder injury. Are you still doing that, or what kind of workouts do you do with the fellas?
Yeah, it's like there's different trainers. There's like coaches, there's trainers, but you know, I could be the coach that comes in the afternoon and stands on the ring apron, just does the sparring and wraps the hands. But I like to be involved, and this is the relationship that I was talking about to have with a fighter, because I get up when they get up, and I do the running when they do the running, and then I know exactly what running they're doing. And then I come into the gym and I do the pads, you know, I do all the work with them, so I know exactly what sort of condition they're in. I know mentally what they're thinking, so that, that helps me on the night in the corner, because I know what stays out. I know when they can push on and when they can't. So, you know, that gives that close, tight-knit relationship. And you need, like I say to them all the time, you need the first year as a professional just to get into the professional game, just to be training like a pro. The second year, you start stepping up the levels. You need that, you know, the first 2 years really is just getting into the training, getting into the zone and what really happens in training, because when you go into like 12-round title fights against fighters that are world level, you know, top elite fighters, when they're just as fit as you, when they can take a shot just like you and they can punch hard like you, and then when you're there, you've got to have served that apprenticeship of that deep level of training from the first year right until when you go in, and that's how it develops you as a fighter. And and that's why I like to be there to do every single thing with them. I like to do everything with them, so I know exactly where they are And like we, what you were just saying there, David, about coming back to the corner, there's a minute in the corner break. The first 30 seconds, you're just giving them water and letting them calm down, get their breathing going. The last 30 seconds is for instructions. So you can't overload the human brain
sure.
with 3, 4, 5, 6 things, a couple of things. They know what they've trained for. They know what they're doing, everything they've learned in the gym. So you just let them know a couple of things that you might want to just tweak a little bit, you know, and then they go out and box.
I like that. And just one calm, cool voice in the corner and not overload the fighter. You've been in some different corners. You actually cornered some of Tyson Fury's fights, a couple of those early on, right, with Rob McCracken?
No, I done one fight. And I believe Rob done two fights. We've done them separately. I done the first John McDermott fight when Tyson won the English title. It was a controversial decision, but I don't think Tyson was in the greatest shape in them days. And it was just like a last-minute phone call, I think, from Mick Hennessy, who was working with at the time. And I ended up going to Brentwood, where the fight was actually where I live.
Sure.
And, you know, done his corner. And then I think Rob trained him after that fight. I think Tyson started training with Rob up in Sheffield, from Manchester, Sheffield. But I don't think that, you know, lasted too long. I think he might have done one fight or two fights with him. So we're probably the only two trainers in the country who have both been in Tyson Fury and Joshua's corner. And
which leads me to the question.
Yeah.
I don't even need to ask it. What do you think? What do you think of the fight?
You know,
how do you see it?
That's what the interviews have been a week about, really, is asking me my opinion. And it's a very difficult fight to call, because, you know, two Brits fighting for the undisputed champion heavyweight championship of the world. If you look at their past performances, you know, they're unbelievable fighters, both of them, and they've both got the ability to beat one another, and that's why everyone's looking forward so much to watching the fight. And if you look at Tyson's lackluster performances in some of his fights, if you look at the two fights leading up to the first Wilder fight, you know, he looked terrible, and you would never have thought that he'd be able to pull that fight off. I know he got a draw, but he still boxed fantastic. You didn't see that coming. And then in the return fight, you would never have seen, when he told everyone what he was going to do. He said, I'm going to walk out there and knock him out.
And then he did it.
And he did it. So that's what sort of fight you're dealing with. And then on the other flip of the coin is Joshua. You know, Joshua's a machine in the gym. You know, he's a great fighter. He can punch, he can box. You know, and then you see him, his lackluster performance against Ruiz. There was rumours circling that he weren't well for that fight. I don't know that for sure, but beforehand he weren't well. But even so, you see him come back, put a performance into at point Ruiz, and then you see his last performance against Pulev. So you don't know. One minute you think Tyson Fury might have the better ability, natural boxing skills, and then you look at the power and, you know, the development and the fitness that Joshua has. And, you know, maybe you start leaning at Joshua, but it's one of them fights that you would not want to put your ass on either one of them, because you just can't call it.
And that's why I love it. I think you're spot on. It's so hard to call, and that's what makes it such a compelling fight. You know, it's funny, right outside here, I know the people can't see us right now, but we've got Darren Barker cutting up, throwing a football, having fun. And that leads me to like some stuff that there's some great stories about you in the gym and him, because it's not all business. There's a lot of fun too, right? So, Joe, I don't know if you have any stories like this, but, you know, D was telling me a story about, you know, you'd put there was one fighter you guys were messing with. You put his gloves on, so he's all gloved up. And then before he put his gum shield in, he put this hot sauce called Ass Blaster.
Yeah, they told me about that one.
Yeah. And then he put it in the mouth and the guy couldn't get it. Do you remember that?
I remember that, yeah.
Tell me about doing stuff with like Tiger Bomb and the jock strap.
We do it now, yeah. In the gym now. Like if one guy goes in the showers, then the other guy will fill the jug up with freezing cold water and blast him with it, and then take the photo of it.
Well, when we done, I remember I filled a, because whoever leaves shower gel in the, like, no one brings shower gel these days. Yeah. I do. A couple of us do. But, like, you had, at the time, Charles Frankham, Felix, Ted, Connor, Spider, they don't bring shower gel. So whoever's left shower gel in the, it's gone by the next day. So the one day, they're all waiting for the shower. So I filled up. I had biofreeze. So I filled biofreeze up. I filled the empty shower gel up with biofreeze. So Charles Frankham have gone in the shower. So we're videoing him just at the door. So he's come out. He's gone, "What's in this?" He said, "My face." He said, "It's burning." He said, my head. He said, "My back." So yeah, he was on fire. He was, but yeah, we have the crack in the gym all the time.
Oh, that's great, man. I mean, well, you know, it's funny because I wanted to ask you about your current stable of fighters, and there's a lot we're gonna go through, but there's a couple that aren't with you anymore. Charles Frankham's one of them. Now I'm wondering, is this why Charles isn't there? What did you do to Doherty? What did you do to Frankham? Okay,
he never recovered from the biofreeze. He ended his career.
It's frozen.
It's frozen. I'll tell you, man. You do have a great current crop of fighters. You got Ted Cheeseman, obviously in a huge British super welterweight title fight against JJ Metcalf. Kid Shamrock, 21-0, 13 KOs from Liverpool. That fight's going to be next week. That's out in Gibraltar. I'm going to be there. Can't wait to call it. Very exciting. How's Cheeseman looking?
Yeah, Cheeseman's in good shape. He was ready for March the 6th, so I had to give him a few days off and pull him back a little bit, but he's raring to go now. He finished his last day of sparring today, and you know, he's just raring to go, really. So he's on weight, and he's had a long camp, and he's ready. But as you say, JJ Metcalf, good fighter, unbeaten in 21 fights. Everyone knows his dad, Shane Neary, who's a great fighter and an old friend of mine as well, and respect him loads. And I think, you know, looking at both their styles, at some point in the fight, they're going to end up in a toe-to-toe job. And that's what Ted likes, whatever you try to do with
that's
Ted.
That's his specialty.
Whatever you try to do with Ted, sooner or later, you know that's going to happen. And then, you know, he was like fight of the year with Egerton in fight camp. And, you know, there's nothing to say that this might not be fight of the year as well. And, you know, it's an exciting fight and another 50-50 fight as well. I think both camps know that. Obviously, JJ Metcalf, it's a big step up for him. He's not boxed, you know, anyone near Ted's class or ability yet. And Ted's had, even though Ted's younger, at 25 years old, I think this is like his 7th or 8th, 12 rounder in a row.
Yeah, so he's got some miles.
Yeah, so he's fought a lot of good class fighters. So, you know, I think, as I said, the styles are going to gel, I think, and I think it's going to be an exciting fight.
Yeah, I can't wait for it. You know, it's funny you say you had to pull him back. I mean, Ted always just seems to be in great shape. He must just be such a gym rat.
He loves training, and, you know, he's great when you get a fighter who loves training, you know, and that's his A side to him. You know, he loves training, he loves conditioning, he eats well, you know, he lives well, and, you know, and he loves to fight, and you know, he reminds me of, like, if you go back to, he probably comes back from a day what would be more suited into like the 1950s or 40s or whatever, when you had the likes of Jack Kidd Bird and Ted Kidd Lewis. He reminds me of one of them fighters, you know, the nose and the ears, and just have your bag and just in condition and want to fight 15, 20 rounds. He reminds me of one of them guys.
100%.
He's definitely a throwback, but, you know, we know him very well as the Joker in the gym as well, and the Joe will tell you that. And because away from, obviously, you only see him on camera when he's serious, but he is a great joker of the gym, you know, and he's a great personality.
So, speaking of more guys in your stable, obviously you got Felix Cash undefeated, and he's got a shot at the British middleweight title against Denzel Bentley, the Londoner, who's also undefeated, 14-0. He's got a draw, and he's got 12 knockouts in those 14 wins. It's not on a Matchroom show. Was there any concern about taking that fight after the purse bid?
Well, you know, Eddie bid for it, but just got pipped, and he's obviously you want to fight on your own show, but Eddie offered Felix an alternative to fight for the European title against the Italian Cigani. But I think Felix, we sat down and spoke, and I think Felix and me really want him to win the British title and then go on to the European title afterwards rather than go European and then take a step back for the British. So I think it's the right route for him. He fancies the fight against Denzel. Denzel's a good fighter. He can punch. You know, he's pretty awkward. But if you look at the caliber of where Felix Cash has come from, he's been on the GB squad. He was on the GB squad with Joe. He comes from a good pedigree of fighter, and he's got a lot of ability. He's improved loads. And, you know, he wants to capture the British title. He's a big thing for a British fighter to win the Lonsdale belt. So, you know, that's his next fight, and it's exciting with two undefeated fighters contesting the British title. You know, and the last time I'd done this was on a Warren show when John Ryder fought Billy Joe Saunders, and they was both unbeaten at the time, and Billy Joe just pipped John then, but it was a great fight. And, you know, hopefully Felix comes out victorious this time for me on the Frank Warren show.
So let's talk about John just for a second. Let's just move up. Let's move up a weight. We've heard that there's a potential shot at the WBA regular title. Is that in the offering? Any news? I mean, you know, I think John's just a great guy, and we all think he deserves a shot.
Yeah, I was talking to Eddie Earn earlier about this today, and it's a bit of it's a bit difficult at the minute because I'll just explain the situation. Really, is that John was in line for the regular title once Canelo vacated. And the Cuban, David Morrell, who's only had four pro fights, he won the interim in his third fight. He's a class amateur. And basically, they was going to contest for the vacant title. Now, in the meantime, the WBA have basically sent the belt in the post, the WBA regular belt in the post to David Morrell because he's the interim champion. And so now John's the challenger, which makes a lot of difference with the purse money because challenger and champions money is a lot different. So I think Eddie's a bit worried about, because it can go to purse bids, I think he's a bit worried about John's percentage in the fight and is it a worthwhile trip for John to go to the States? Because John's like number seven in the Ring magazine ratings. He's like quite a big name in the super middleweight division. And would it be John worthwhile John taking a small purse to go maybe on a PBC show and fight David Morrell? Like, you know, these are the things that you got to try and sum up, whether it be worthwhile or does Eddie land a different big fight in the UK for John. Now, the problem there is as well is that Canelo sort of owning all the titles at the minute. He's got two of the belts. He's fighting Billy Joe for a third belt. And then the only other belt is Caleb Plant, who's looking to fight Canelo as well in his next fight. So there's a possibility that John could just be fighting maybe for decent money in big fights without getting a world title shot. So we're sort of weighing up that situation. It's a difficult situation to come to a decision on.
I can't wait to see what happens, and we'll be watching the situation very closely. Moving on through the stable, Martin J. Ward. Joe, that's someone in your weight class. And, you know, the other day I had CBS, Chris Billam-Smith, and Lawrence Okolie in the booth. Obviously, they're stable mates, and they both campaign at Cruiser. So I asked them, and I got to ask you, if a fight was offered for a world title down the line, what would happen there? Would you guys face each other?
Nah. Yeah, no. We're good friends. We're stable mates.
Depends on the money, Joe.
If the money's big,
big, then I'll get percentage of both of them. I'll chuck them in together.
Yeah. There you go.
I'm only joking.
We just have a neck around each and we have a draw. Yeah. Yeah, we call it a draw, boys. We call it a draw. Yeah. But we wouldn't box. Yeah, we're good friends. We're stable mates. And any normal stable wouldn't do that. So. Yeah, I just think, and I don't think Tony would put us in together anyway. So it, it's just who's in sort of a better position. If he's obviously higher ranked in a certain governing body, yeah, crack on, do your thing. If I'm in a different one and I get offered and he's behind me, yeah, I'll do my thing. So yeah, it's just, we can go different routes. There's four belts, we go different routes.
Sure. And of course, Connor, the Destroyer, Ben. Got to talk about him real quick. Obviously, he's fighting Sammy Vargas on April 10th. How's that going? I mean, speaking of the Ben name, I know you and Nigel go way back. You know, when did you guys first meet? What's it like training Connor now? Another great story that Barker, he's been a wealth of knowledge about you, Tony. But there was a story he was telling me that he was in the gym and you were teaching about head movement one day and you were showing him a tape of Nigel Benn and you're saying, see how he moves his head and this, that. So he says, yeah, I like that. And he's watching. He says, well, who's the guy he's fighting? You said, oh, that's me. And
Joe's seen that tape.
Yeah, you show me.
Yeah. It's an old tape that is. But yeah, I've known Nigel for years. Like, we come from the same sort of area. And funny enough, I knew Connor's mum before Nigel knew her. He's a great man. Nigel Benn is a legend in the sport. You know, whoever was about in them days when Nigel was world champion, you know, it was always divided, Eubank and Nigel Benn, who you liked. But most people love Nigel. They love watching Nigel because with Nigel, he brings excitement. You know, he can be fragile when he's it. And then just when you think that he's done, you know, he comes back. And then, you know, he was like the destroyer. He just come back and give it everything and, you know, put the lights out on the opponent. And, you know, as we're saying, he was a great fighter and he's a lovely, lovely man. And he's put me in charge of his son as a friend. He's asked me, obviously, he lives in Australia. As a friend, you know, he's asked me to look after his son, which obviously is a great honour, but obviously a great responsibility as well, because, you know, I have to be like a second father to Connor here as well, because he's not got his dad to go and ask questions or opinions about. So, I know he speaks to him on the phone regular, but sometimes your emotions, you need to sit down with someone and ask their opinion. So, you know, I've told Nigel that I look after him through his career, and I believe that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing Connor against Sammy Vargas. It's a great fight. You must have been relieved that his comeback fight fell through. He was supposed to fight in Birmingham, and he hurt his shoulder. He was going to fight Saki Obika.
Yeah, I was relieved. You know, I didn't believe that was a good move at all, and he knew that as well. I told him, you know, I just didn't want him to see him fight. You know, he's like watching the recent Mike Tyson, Roy Jones Jr. fight. You know, they ain't the same. You know, their names are the same, but they're not the same fighter. And, you know, you're watching them and it's just like, I know they got a lot of money for doing it, and that was one of the reasons why Nigel wanted to do it. But it was just like the opponent as well, Saki Obika. He was still active up until 2 years previous. And it was different if Nigel was going to maybe fight Eubank or one of the guys that ain't fought, or Steve Collins, one of them guys who ain't fought just as long as him. But he was like putting himself in a dangerous predicament, and I weren't happy with it one bit, you know. And I told him that. And when he wanted a spar, I think it was his first or second spar, and his shoulder went, and I just went to him, Nigel, that's it, mate.
Yeah.
You know, you're done. Like, your body can't hold up to this sort of training. And he went, yeah, you're right. And I think he realized then.
Father Time's undefeated.
Yeah.
You know, he found religion, and he really kind of turned his life around with that. I know you guys also, both, faith plays a big part in your lives.
Yeah, faith is a massive part of my life. And it was funny because because obviously Nigel moved abroad and then he moved to Australia, so I hadn't seen him for a long, long time. Didn't really know that his faith was, he was born again, and he didn't know I was born again, because we just like didn't see each other. And that was another like a weird experience, because he'd come over here with Connor, and he took Connor to Ricky Atten's gym to train with Ricky Atten. And then obviously he'd heard that I was training at the Matron gym, and he got my number through somebody and rung me up, and he said, oh, it's Nigel, but I hadn't spoke to him for years. And he said, can I bring my boy down to your gym? He's only 19. If you've got any sparring for him. So I went, yeah. And basically he brought him to the gym. And that was it. You know, he ended up coming with me. So that was another, I always say to him, that was another God experience, that God was watching over you, Connor, and Nigel. And God brought you from Manchester to not even thinking that you was ever going to leave there, brought you down to my gym out the blue. And the next thing you know, I'm looking after you. So I believe that God played a big part in that.
Joe, you are a lot of tattoos. You have a tattoo on your back, something Joshua Buatsi told you a verse, and it was something that, can you tell us about that?
Isaiah 41:10. We were in Bulgaria or Romania. Bulgaria. And we were in a final of a tournament, and every fighter used to pray with me all the time. And I started getting like deep into my religion. I'm a Catholic. I didn't get baptized till I was like 10. I went to a Catholic school, everything, and only probably around about 2013, 2014, I started getting sort of interested and sort of deep into it. So I started reading the Bible. Although, like, when I'm reading, I can't really make sense of what's being said. I think I got a short attention span. So I started, he showed me an app, the Bible app on the phone. So I was listening to it. So every night I started listening to it, and I picked up a verse. So I went through it, and he said, listen, he said, I was going to tell you that. So anyway, cut long story short, every fight then he was praying with me. And a couple of tournaments down the line, he mentioned that verse again. And it's just stuck with me. And it's just such a strong verse that I just thought, do you know what? And I got it on my shirt, on my back. And yeah, religion plays a big part in my life.
Tony, I got another great Barker story. Speaking of church. So he told me a story. You guys were in Niagara Falls one time, and he's also a man of faith, and you guys wanted to go to church. And so you found a church and you walked in, and what tell us about that. What happened? Do you remember this?
Oh yeah, I remember. Yeah. And that's the great thing about faith, you know, Christianity, is because it speaks every language. And we walked into the church not knowingly that it was all China, they only spoke Mandarin in the church. And the whole service was in Mandarin, you know. So we didn't know that, obviously, but we were sitting in the church, obviously not understanding anything was going on, but we knew they were singing about Jesus. And then halfway through the service, one of the guys come up to us and said, like, you don't understand what we're talking about in the service, dear. So obviously not, because we're the only like four white people in here. And he explained the service to us. And, you know, and then afterwards, when the service finished, he invited us round his house for dinner. And that's the beautiful thing about faith and going to church. And it don't matter what race you are, is that it plays a massive factor, you know, it can play a massive factor in your life, faith.
It's great stuff. You guys are both family men. Joe, you've got two daughters. You got a son on the way. Congratulations.
Yeah. Actually, it was the 20-week scan today. So just thank God it was everything was fine. He was healthy. And August.
Beautiful. This is a driving force for you to succeed here? How's this?
Of course. I think back, it was like 2015. I was sort of, I'm in an iron whether to sort of walk away from boxing at a point, because I, being on the GB squad and being having a daughter on the way, it was just, I got to start thinking about putting food on the table. And being up in Sheffield and earning the money you're earning is not great money. So I was thinking about walking away, and I thought, you know what, I got a kid on the way, let me have one shot at him proper, go at it hard. Because I sort of flirted with boxing, but I didn't take it. You're around boys all the time, as like you'll speak to Fowler, Akoli, you're all having a laugh, but sometimes it gets a bit silly and you don't really concentrate. When you go into tournaments, it doesn't matter if you lose, you go to the next tournament, you could win it. So it wasn't such a big thing about having a loss as an amateur, but I thought, let me give it a good old whack now. So I've gone out, I'm won the Europeans, but every run, every session, I was going into, I just kept thinking about my unborn baby then, and how am I going to be able to provide? If I don't make an Olympic Games, I ain't going to be able to provide for my kids. And I think I went to the, she was born. I remember she was born. I said to Lauren, I just made sure she was okay. I said, everything cool? I said, yeah. I said, I'm going to the gym. I'll be back in a bit. So I've left the hospital, gone to the gym, came back, made sure everything was okay. We had to stay in overnight. And then done the same thing. I had to go back in the evening, go for a run in the evening. So it was just like, yeah, it pushes me on. And I need to win world titles to secure my family and be able to give my kids whatever they want. And I never had a hard upbringing. I got given everything. My dad, my mum give me everything I wanted. They weren't well off, but they give me everything I wanted and made sure I went without, I didn't want for nothing, basically. And that's what I want to do for my kids and give them even more. So yeah, I have to succeed for them.
Speaking of world titles, Joe, super featherweight, it is a tough division. Shark-infested waters. How do you see yourself matching up with the guys at the top of the division? How do you gauge yourself? And do you even get sparring with anyone on that top level? I mean, the top guys in the division right now that I'm looking at. I mean, did you see the Burchell Valdez fight?
Yeah.
Incredible fight, yeah. By the way.
Yeah.
And congratulations to Oscar Valdez. But, you know, obviously Tank Davis, Jojo Diaz, Jamel Herring, Tevin Farmer, Shakur Stevenson. You got Rakhimov. So it's a tough division.
Yeah, but technically, I'm there, and if not better than some of them. So they've all gone through the same sort of steps I went through as an amateur.
Mm.
Some of them haven't achieved what I've achieved in the amateurs. So technically, I believe I'm there. It's just about gaining that a little bit more experience at the next level up. So yeah, maybe a couple more fights at a higher level than what I've been boxing at, and then I think I'm ready. I'm ready for them. Like I said, technically I'm there.
You know, there's so much I want to talk to both of you guys about more, but it's been great. But we do have to start winding it down a bit. So it's going to be time now for the rapid fire questions. This is a part of the show where the fans ask you guys questions. Okay, so at All Hail the Bluebirds asks Joe, how are you finding life down at super featherweight as opposed to lightweight? What's the science behind moving down a weight?
With the pandemic, it's been a bit tough again back down, because obviously I haven't made weight for 16 months. The last time was in Monte Carlo with 2019. So yeah, it's been a bit tougher than usual, but I'm sure today I didn't train yesterday. I trained Wednesday morning. And I was 132 pounds. So, 132 was I? 132.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I was 132 pounds, or 2 pound over. There's nothing, and I didn't train yesterday. So, I don't think I'm gonna struggle or anything. But like Tony said in a previous question, at a British level, you're able to do certain things. But when you step up the levels, and I got one hand, and they're just as big as the likes of Gavin Gwynn. At that level, I can box with one hand and use my skills and get around certain things. And Tanoko, I can get around certain things that they're doing or bringing. But when you start stepping up the levels, the world level, they can all punch, especially at lightweight. They're all just as big as Gavin Gwynn. They're all physically strong. And you're going to have two hands to try and keep them off, at least. So, I just think it was a mutual decision between Tony and my strength and conditioning coach, Dan Lawrence, and myself, to sort of give myself the best opportunity to win a world title, which was down at super feather.
130 pounds. All right. Steve Wright asks Tony, you seem to only train Matchroom fighters. Is that the case? Or would you make an exception to the rule for an elite fighter?
That's the case. Yeah.
Just Matchroom fighters.
Just Matchroom fighters. I think Eddie would fire me if I trained any other fighter. obviously, Eddie's a partner in the Matchroom gym with me, so it'd be difficult for me to train a fighter from a different promotional outfit and then train him in the gym that Eddie's half paying for. So, you know, not only that, anyway, I enjoy working with Matchroom. I've worked from him. You got to realise Darren Barker was the first signing that Eddie signed with me.
And it was your first world champion too, right?
Yeah, and then Eddie's second fighter was Carl Froch, and I put that deal together between him and Rob McCracken. So the first two fighters, like, come from me to Matchroom. So, you know, I'm just Matchroom through and through, and I always have been and always will be, you know, and I just train Matchroom fighters.
This is killing me, man, because you're bringing up Carl Froch. This is, like, something that I just wanted to ask, because I know that you worked Carl's corner on some of his biggest nights, and, of course, Joe Calzaghe, arguably one of the greatest, you know, ever to do it, super middleweight. If they got it on, who would have won?
It depends in what stage of their careers, because when Carl and Joe Calzaghe was mooted to fight, obviously Joe was at the very tail end of his career, and Carl was, like, you know, just become world champion. So, you know, at that stage there, you would have maybe fancied Carl to win the fight. But if you go to maybe both at their peaks, I think maybe Joe would have beaten Carl, because he had an elusive style, he had fast hands, you know, and I think at both at their peaks, I think Joe was probably, you know, probably would have beat Carl.
And you're also saying that because you've got a Welshman sitting next to you too. And yeah,
both great fighters, by the way, both fantastic fighters.
100%, 100%. All right, let's go on with it, because we gotta start wrapping it up. All right, Trevor Jones asks Joe, your fellow countryman Liam Williams bids to become world champion just under a month against Demetrius Andrade. Can he do it?
Yes, yeah, he can do it. I think Liam is a spiteful fighter. He's horrible to be in there with. He'll make it rough. Yeah, he's with a different promotional company. And Boo Boo Andrade is with Matchroom, but I just think Liam's more than capable, and I believe he can get the job done.
It's going to be an exciting fight. Can't wait. let's see. Helen Robinson asks Tony, would you ever consider training a female fighter? Have you ever had any discussions? Excuse me if I've got that off, and if you trained a lady previously.
No, I've never trained a lady. I'm not against women's boxing. In fact, I'm all for it. But maybe I'm a bit old school. You know, I come from 70s boxing, and you know, I don't know really. It's an odd one to say, really. But the stable I've got now with, I train 6 fighters individually, and I like to spend all my time individually with them. You know, I don't think I would have time to train another fighter, whether it be male or female. But listen, I'm all for women's boxing or whatever women are doing in their life. You know, I think they're entitled to do whatever sport they want to do. You know, and if you look at Katie Taylor, great, great fighter, and, you know, fair play to him.
Speaking of Katie Taylor, you know, we were talking about Clarissa Shields, and hopefully the Savannah Marshall fight will happen. The fight I want to see, Kate, I want to see your fight Amanda Serrano. So anyway, that's just a side note there. Okay, Martin the True Mexican asks Joe, Frampton versus Herring is a fight I'm sure you'll have your eye on. Who wins, and what route are you going?
With that fight, I think it's, like, Jamal Herring, he used to box in amateurs at 64 kilo when he was big for 64 kilo. Now, for him to drop down to super featherweight, which is 58.9, he's massive. And I just think Carl Frampton, I just think he's going to be a little bit too small. Although you never know with Carl Frampton, he's talented, and he can punch. You can never write him off, so... Yeah, but if I had a 10, I'd chuck it on Jamal Herron.
All right. Peter Richardson asks Tony, this is the final question here, do you have a preferred brand of glove you encourage your fighters to use?
No, the fighters use, you know, whatever glove they feel comfortable with. And I think, like, out of all my 6 fighters, I think they all wear individual brands. So it's funny you asked that question, because a brand – who I know very well asked me to put them forward so they can, Matchroom can use the gloves. But I explained to him that each fighter is individual, whatever gloves they want to wear. So it's not up to anybody else other than the fighter himself what he wears.
All right. So look, guys, that's it from Fight Week. It's a wrap. Today's exclusive. We always do an exclusive. So today's exclusive, it's actually more of a teaser. So if you're listening to this on Friday afternoon, we're going to be breaking some huge news approximately 7 p.m. UK time tonight. So stay tuned across our social channels for all the latest. All eyes are on tomorrow night's show, live on Sky Sports in the UK and Ireland and DAZN around the globes. Joe, Tony, thank you so much for your time, and I wish you the best of luck tomorrow. It's really been great talking to you guys. I appreciate it. And next week, we're in sunny Gibraltar. Tony, we'll see you there, too, with the Big Cheese, obviously. And until then, I'm David Diamante. Stay tuned for more Matchroom Radio.